Welcome to Shared Weight and the story of the Gilchrist brothers, of Republican Congressman Wayne Gilchrist, who's represented the 1st Congressional District in Maryland for 8 terms. He was a Marine sergeant in Vietnam who saw combat in 1965. His brothers, Jeffrey and Alan, who served with him in Vietnam, Brother Richard, who served in the Navy, and Clifford, who remained home to teach. We join the brothers as they reflect on how their views of the world have grown since that war and been affected by that war. First, the news from National Public Radio. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Shared Weight, a radio documentary series 30 years after the end of the Vietnam War. This hour, we bring you the Gilchrist brothers. Wayne Gilchrist is a Republican congressman who's represented the 1st Congressional District in Maryland for 8 terms. He was a Marine sergeant in Vietnam who saw combat in 1965. I first interviewed him 14 years ago on Capitol Hill for my radio show. I didn't know then he was a vet, until he ran John McCain's presidential campaign in Maryland in the year 2000. We knew we had to interview Wayne Gilchrist after I heard the story about how incensed he was that a young soldier, one of his constituents, was killed in Iraq, would not be given the Purple Heart, because his death was an accident and not in combat. Wayne rummaged through his box of medals from his days in Vietnam. He took out one of his Purple Hearts, and he pinned it on the young man as he lay in the coffin. So we met him at his home in Kennedyville, in rural Kent County, on the eastern shore of Maryland. It was the morning of his son's wedding, and we met him with 4 of his 5 brothers.
This is Mark Steiner.
Hi.
My Aunt Jo.
Good morning. Nice to meet you.
This is Goody.
How do you do?
Pleasure.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Andrew.
This is Nick.
Nick Bridger. Nice to meet you.
We walked into Wayne's home to meet his brothers and start our conversation about the war. From the perspective of these brothers, 3 of whom served in Vietnam at the same time, they grew up in a small town in New Jersey, in a deeply conservative working class family.
I'm Cliff, number 1, Bath County, Virginia.
My name is Alan Gilchrist, and I'm the number 2 son. And I'm from Rahway, New Jersey.
Jeffrey, number
3.
Thank you, Alan. Number 3, Newland, North Carolina.
Wayne, number 4, Kennedyville, Maryland.
Hey, my name is Rich Gilchrist. I'm number 5 son, and we're currently living in Toms River, New Jersey.
And David, number 6, who's not here, is from
Provincetown
or Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
You were in the Marines. You joined the Marines when?
64, out of high school, 18.
And Jeffrey, you were?
I was in the Army.
66.
You were drafted.
I was drafted, and Mom says, you're going to enlist, so I did.
Did you want to go?
I was saving up for an engagement ring, so obviously I didn't want to go. But I went anyhow, and I enlisted. I didn't get drafted.
Okay. And Alan, you were in the
I went in October, 18, out of high school.
62.
Yeah, into the Navy. And then after 2 years, and actually in D.C. in the Pentagon, I volunteered for Vietnam.
I enlisted in the Navy. I came home from work one day, and I had an invitation to join the Army on the table. So I sat down at lunch with my father, and I looked at him and said, I think that's my draft notice. I said, I'm going to go up to Elizabeth and enlist in the Navy. He said, I'm going to sleep in the dirt. I'll sleep on a clean bunk. The Navy has clean bunks. And he said, not a bad idea. You're going to take the bus or the car. I said, I'll take the bus. So I went up and enlisted. That was in 66.
And you're the oldest.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm the oldest.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm one of the 2 of our family who never served in the military.
And I just want to add, too, back then, the draft basically hit the 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old single. And when it did, it, I guess right on the cusp, Cliff wasn't drafted, he was married. And we all said, lucky bum. But anyhow.
The truth be told, I don't think, I certainly admired and truly admired my brothers who served, whether it be Rich in the Navy who didn't get sent to Vietnam or these three guys who did.
Well, it would have been too much for Mom and Dad. They needed some anchors at home, and you guys were the anchors.
We had to pay the phone bill.
We were crazy enough to volunteer to go to Vietnam.
And you all served where? And once went to Vietnam, you all served where in Nam? Where did you serve, Alan?
I was in National Military Command Center in NMCC in Saigon, Tansanut area. That was it was just a war room game, a war room. And that's where everything originated from.
Wayne was the John Wayne. We were the clerical. I worked for the Tactical Operations Center. I had reported to the United States MIAs, KIAs, and WIAs, which in a way was rather frustrating because I was told by who and what and where, what to write and what to send back, knowing what I was leaving out.
What do you mean, knowing what you were leaving out?
Information I want that the people in the United States were not supposed to know.
I was with, I was in what we called I Corps. The Vietnam was divided into four regions. I was in number one, which was by the DMZ, the northern part of Vietnam, and we called it I Corps. And so we moved around fairly often from near the DMZ to the Laotian border to near Da Nang, and we moved around there depending on the action or the activity of the VC or the North Vietnamese Army.
Wayne, let me just focus on you for a minute. You, of the three brothers, the four brothers who served, the three that were in Nam, you're the one who saw combat.
Yes. You know, you think differently at, when you're an 18, 19-year-old than you do when you're in your 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you just you heard stories about Korea, you heard stories about Guadalcanal, you heard stories about D-Day. Plus, I just wanted to see the world, so I had an idea one of the best ways to do it, because it seemed exciting. Plus, the recruiter painted this magnificent picture of adventure and life around the world and what you could do as a young Marine. I was sold, so I took a bus to Elizabeth and enlisted without telling my parents.
Oh,
but I didn't
that.
Tell my parents or anyone else that I was due to go July the 15th, 1964, to Parris Island, and I didn't tell my parents until Monday night before that Wednesday, which I regret to this day.
Why do you regret that?
Because when I got on the bus on the corner to go to Newark Airport to fly to Parris Island, both my parents walked me to the bus stop. And I to this day, what is vivid in my memory is seeing their faces, that they knew that I wasn't ever going to come back the same way. They knew it. You know, I didn't know it. So I get on the bus, I want this great excitement, and I could still see the look in their eyes, partly because I didn't tell them. The second thing that happened was when I got off the bus in Parris Island, I said, oh my God, I made a mistake. This guy hollered at me. And I had heard from some of the men in our neighborhood that they told me stories about it, which I really didn't believe. One of the stories was that there's no seat cover on the toilets. We don't have a toilet seat. You just have the toilet.
And you have to share it with 100 guys.
So when the first thing off the bus, we went to the head, and I saw that there were no toilets. He says, oh, my God, everything else they told me is going to be true.
What was it about your family and your parents and the town you grew up in that, you mean, you almost felt compelled? You had to...
Well, we grew up in a neighborhood where everybody was either a World War II vet or a Korean War vet, that we had very close, intimate contact with on a regular basis.
There was one, Charlie Wilson, across the street from the Korean War. He was still, I guess, in shell shock. He never over the war.
He
would just stand out in the middle of the street or on the sidewalk and just stare off into space. Yeah. That was an ongoing thing the whole time that we were growing up. And that's the effects of him being in the Korean War. So that's just how we grew up, and we saw both ends of it.
And Andy Rusin was on Utah Beach on D-Day.
Yes,
And yes. Leo Strakowski was on Guadalcanal.
Guadalcanal,
both.
Next door.
Yeah,
constant, from the time we were five until we were in high school, we were influenced by these people. Day by day, they were our neighbors, and most of them drank.
Some of them.
Alcohol was a big part of their life.
Wayne's tour of duty in Vietnam overlapped with his brothers Jeffrey in the Army and Alan in the Navy. Three brothers in the same war at the same time. Jeffrey remembers trying to find his brother Wayne.
CO called me in and said, what company was your brother in? I said, I think he's in Foxtrot. And he goes, well, let's hope not, because there's not too many people left. So I said, I need to go. I got there that night in Da Nang, forget the name of the base. A lot of this stuff, for some reason, does not stay with me. Maybe it's a safety factor, I don't know. But I slept in Wayne's cot. He was out cleaning up the mess of Foxtrot. Mm-hmm.
It was early in the morning. We're trying to get a group of NVA soldiers who kept shooting at our helicopters to take our wounded out that were wounded since 3 a.m. in the morning. So it was around 7 a.m. We go in and there's a little bit of a firefight. I get hit like I was run over by a Mack truck. And I remember hearing the other Marine behind me saying, Sergeant Gilchrist got shot right through the chest. I didn't know what happened. It was that much of an impact. And so there was only a few of us, so they had to go back to get reinforcements. So I was laying on the ground by myself.
Right after I hit the ground, I could see myself, and I can still see myself very clearly from about treetop level. I can see myself on the ground. I can see me laying there. And there was no pain. There was no pain whatsoever. I'm about treetop level. I see myself. I know it's me. There's no fear in me whatsoever. There's no anxiety. It is just me laying on the ground. And then all of a sudden, I feel the pain.
And I could not breathe. The first thing that came into my head was the backyard. Clifford accidentally hit me in the stomach with a bat when we were kids. I don't think I was 10 years old.
The wind got knocked out of me, and Clifford said, relax and breathe through your nose. So I'm laying on the ground in Vietnam. I can't breathe. And so I started very slowly breathing through my nose, shallow breaths. And I realized that I could breathe that way. A little while later, the other Marines come up. There's a bigger firefight. They put me in a poncho. They carry me back to the area where all the other wounded are. This was about 7 a.m. And around 10 o'clock is when it was cleared up enough to get the helicopters.
When they evacuate you after you're wounded, they take you to a place that is exactly like the program MASH. They take you off the helicopter. And they take the people in who are wounded the worst first. And then the doctors operate on you right away. And the first person you see when you wake up after the operation is the chaplain. And the chaplain says, is there a letter I can write for you or someone I can contact? And I said, I have a brother somewhere around Saigon, and I don't know where. And so the next day they flew me in a helicopter to the repos hospital ship. They contacted Jeffrey. Jeffrey flew up there. I had just gotten there, and then within a few hours I'm laying there, and something, I think I'm gonna choke up. Someone was standing right there. And I didn't pay attention to him because I just assumed it was a corpsman or somebody. That person didn't say anything.
Couldn't.
And then I looked, it was Jeffrey. So he stayed with me 3 or 4 days.
We cried and hugged and he went home.
Yeah.
What was it like for you seeing your brother shot at that moment when you flew out there?
Oh, I guess it would be traumatic for anyone.
Yeah.
It wasn't his time to go because I saw them sew him up, especially the back. I'm not sure what was holding his back together. But anyhow, he's here. And you live that over and over a lot sometimes.
I was shot in May 67.
Mother's Day.
Mother's Day. May 14th.
He was shot on Mother's Day. And my mother knew it.
March. I always have a Bush Light on May 14th.
Say, what do you mean your mother knew?
No, she said there was something wrong. When he was shot, well, it was on Mother's Day, and she felt something before the military came to the house. You know, they send the enlisted man. If you see the officers coming, you're gone. Right. That is a sinking feeling. So I knew, turn around, but I saw it enlisted. So we knew it wasn't
Knew he wasn't dead.
You knew it wasn't serious.
Knew he wasn't gone. He didn't stay at the treetop. He came back down.
That was fine. That was fine.
The treetop was just a temporary.
Temporary.
In other words, you were given a chance. Let's change our minds again. I want to experience something else.
It's that round trip ticket thing.
Right.
Round trip ticket.
Maybe I won't re-up.
She alluded to it that day on Mother's Day that she had this feeling. That something happened. When it happened?
Long before the Marine shot up the door.
Oh, no, that day that he was shot, my mom said she felt something.
Wayne Gilchrist was badly wounded in Vietnam. Jeffrey was deeply affected by what happened to his brother and the work he had to do in contacting the families of the killed, the wounded, and the missing. And Alan came home to continue in the Navy Reserve. They came home different men than the ones who left for war. And these very patriotic men began to feel the weight of returning home to a nation divided, to protesters in the streets. We'll be back in a minute with the Gilchrist brothers. Welcome back to Shared Weight and the story of the Gilchrist brothers. We now speak to the brothers who did not serve in Vietnam. The oldest brother, Clifford, who became a teacher, and Richard joined the Navy and served with NATO in Belfast, Northern Ireland. Clifford reflects on his time home.
As my teaching career evolved, I think one of the seminal moments, and actually it wasn't a moment, it was a period of time, while these guys were in the service, there were things going on. I remember my first presidential election that I could vote in, because I hadn't passed the 26th Amendment, was Johnson-Goldwater.
Right.
The only Republican I've ever voted for president was Goldwater, because I didn't like Johnson's ad with the little girl dancing through the fields.
The famous Daisy.
And the cloud, the mushroom cloud. But I couldn't vote for Johnson after that. And I think knowing where these guys were and not knowing what was going on, being very, very suspicious of what we learned and what we didn't know, encouraged me to become the kind of teacher that I eventually became. Trying to provoke my kids into learning as much as they could, questioning authority in a responsible, respectful way, but questioning what you were being told, questioning why should we do it this way? Is there another way we could do it? Encouraging my students to recognize that little book that we refer to as the Constitution, well, it's just a tiny little thing when you consider all of it put together. But If we truly took to heart what that preamble, the six goals in the preamble, what kind of a nation would we really be if we adhered to those six goals? And I think, as I reflect upon it, thinking about what they experienced, certainly I can only imagine what it was like to be there in any of their shoes, but I think that encouraged me to become the kind of teacher I sought to become. And I think part of that was also because I felt that I wasn't doing my part like they were.
But you felt that then for a while?
Yeah. For a number of years, I felt it. I felt somewhat guilty and a level of being maybe a little irresponsible and self-indulgent because I was unwilling to take that step.
And Brother Richard shares what many men who served in the Vietnam era felt about that war.
Obviously, didn't serve in Vietnam. My Navy service was spent in a NATO communications base in Northern Ireland on the top of a mountain. Listening to what was going on over there, getting the BBC news, which was not as friendly as you would imagine. Our perspective was, if we're going to have to do it, let's do it and get it over with. You know, we keep lollygagging around, move over to here, and we take this area. Then they move back over here, and that area gets re-infiltrated. This is just the most frustrating damn thing in the world. If you're gonna go and do something and stop the dominoes from falling to communism, we're holding the Russians back over here in the North Atlantic. Do something right. So it was very frustrating. From all of the guys that we had, a whole bunch of the guys who were CBs who did a lot of our antenna and radio tower work, almost all of them re-enlisted to go over. It was amazing.
And you can tell your friend there with you, he'll have to go.
I began to explore with Wayne and his brothers how they felt and changed when they came home to the world. Men who really wanted to serve started analyzing where we were as a nation.
Holding you the way I do.
What were your feelings about the anti-war movement here during that time?
I think when we went as young kids, it was a natural assumption that the government was competent and informed.
Right.
And you were patriotic, and you know, people did it before you, so you did it. So you really didn't have too many questions about what got us involved in the conflict in the first place. When we came back, and I was still in the Marine Corps when I came back, stationed at Quantico, there were a lot of anti-war demonstrations in Washington. And I can remember standing out there with an M14 and very pretty young women putting flowers in the barrel of our guns. So our thoughts was not anti-war demonstration. Our thought was, well, you know, this is, maybe I can meet her later. To a man, I'm not kidding you. We as returning vets to Quantico, Virginia, were often in Washington for security purposes. And I think we were not necessarily political. We didn't think about Jane Fonda. We didn't think about anti-war demonstrations, although, you know, we did to the extent that we could. But it was just, you know, we have a few months left. We're going to get out. We're going to live our life. And we still had some sense the government was competent and informed. Gradually, though, as we began to leave the military, have a job, raise a family, go to college, the Pentagon Papers, a number of periodicals written about the war, we began to see what was left out of the equation was that the government never knew enough. They weren't knowledgeable enough about the history of that region. They compared Ho Chi Minh to Stalin, to Mao Zedong, and Ho Chi Minh wasn't a Stalinist, and he wasn't a Maoist. He was someone that wanted to be free of colonialism. So I began to understand that the U.S. got us involved in a war in Vietnam that never should have happened.
That's true. Gulf of Tonkin never.
Right.
Never happened. And Ho Chi Minh came to the United States first. Actually, Specialist 5 saved his life. And the first country he went to ask for help was the United States,
right,
to be free from that colonialism. And we ignored him. And one thing, but again, at 18, we're all going to lick the world. We're all Rambo. And the military knows that. We're very impressionable. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, you know that, and you put a 50 cal machine gun. I went to the self-protection course in Coronado. Boy, you feel pretty powerful. Throwing those hand grenades and shooting that bar and 30 cal machine gun. Man, you feel invincible. And they know that. They're just professionals at it. And you just get caught up in that. But as time goes on, like the Sarge says, at the time, yes, I hated every anti-demonstration. I was one of those in blind faith that day. I don't know what it is, but and today I look at it as, well, gee, why did 56,000 have to die to open up a sneaker factory? Give me a reason for that.
We began to have this sense that this is one difficult situation, that we're trying to kill mosquitoes with sledgehammers.
Right.
And it's not going to work. And gradually, as we were over there longer, we began to pick up the idea, because McNamara was the Secretary of Defense. When I first got there, he said the war will be over in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then we just knew that wasn't true.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California.
Patriotism runs red, white, and blue in these men's veins. They harken back to another era and to the future.
To the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me.
To be questioned by those in authority now that if we don't agree with them, we're morally wrong, it is just totally false. I'm patriotic. I can't go to Vietnam War without crying. I cry every time somebody steps on a landmine, because it's totally uncalled for. I truly believe that those mothers and fathers would rather see their son or daughter grow up and be married and have a family. That flag has nothing to do with glory. That does not replace that son or daughter or loved one. They rather have them home. And that's where they were, back down in another quagmire. And for someone to question my patriotism if we don't agree, see, now we're unpatriotic. It's really sad. It has come to this point. Mm. Very, very sad. I cry at the Star Spangled Banner. Mm. If I'm at a ball game, I sing it, and I sing it loud.
That's a good thing to point out, because of what you said. As I'm listening, it sounds somewhat unpatriotic because of the comments made, but the reason they're made is because of the strong patriotic values that we do have. It's hard for young people to understand that. Right. Our patriotic values go way beyond what anybody is taught today. And I don't think half the people know the Star Spangled Banner.
Well, I just feel that it just saddens me, you know, each time that this thing just becomes, and as the years go on, and it's repetitive, and it does seem light, but I still love my country, and I love to salute the flag and everything, but it has gone past. It's now we're coming into, we're in an area, unfortunately, that we're unable to get along. We're decisive. It's come down to, you know, and if you grow up, the thing, those, if you watch from Eisenhower on, or even a little bit of, both parties were able to talk, both parties were able to discuss, both parties were able to come together. And now, to me, it just seems hatred one for the other. It's just gone beyond a point. And that's very unhealthy. And to suffer for it is the people and the citizens, because of decisiveness, because then they get caught up in that same battle. If you're on this side or on this side, and you just see it constantly now. And this name calling, it's just gone so far beyond what it should be. And it's very hurtful to the country, not to mention our standing around the world. But that's how I feel now, because there was one father who wrote that in the Star Ledger up there, and I said that every time I see that officer or enlisted man kneel down and give that flag, I mean, my heart breaks.
Make the world go away and get it off my shoulders. Say the things you used to say and make the world go away.
Just like Vietnam, I went past that blind patriotism. Then, well, like my brother said, you don't get the facts. Or then, how do you feel when they come out? Well, the Gulf of Tonkin was false, and no one really knew what went on, or what was 200 miles, or what really transpired. But they quick grabbed. And the amazing thing is that every single faction of the government took that as gospel and ran with it. And those who were questioned were silenced at that time in the government. It's amazing how they could do that. But I mean, I understand it's after the fact, but here we are going through the same scenario.
At that time, I would have been an anti-war protester at the time. I believed what I was doing. I believed that the people that taught me to do what I did was right. And under the circumstances, I don't think it was wrong. I just think that I wouldn't hurt an anti-protester now. Because just as they have something to learn about what I've experienced, I've learned from my experience not to judge them. I don't know how else to put it without getting a little riled, but that's about how I feel. They have the right to make their own decisions. I just don't like to see the United States being torn apart.
And although people think it's just their little life, well, a lot of things we do in our world as a group of people reflects throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of sort of remember that, that we are part of a little round blue ball.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
The strength that we have as a nation is that we are, throughout our history, had differences of opinion and been able to tolerate those. And I know, you know, just studying, going back as far as when Jefferson ran, and the amount of hatred. You know, we talk about how it's more divisive now than then, but I remember reading something not that long ago about the kind of name-calling and just ugly, intolerant, and factually contrived pictures made of Jefferson and his opponent then. So, you know, you mentioned before, Alan, the more we change, the more we stay.
The more they stay the same. Too old, too soon, too smart, too late.
There you go. And I think, having had three brothers in Vietnam, while I wasn't conflicted about their service at all, and I certainly honored their service, and I think somewhat empathize Alan's remarks about today and those young men who are being killed and maimed, and the innocent civilians, the untold magnitude of collateral damage, which is one of the ugliest terms, mm-hmm. I've ever, and the way people can use that term, collateral damage, with such casualness, is truly offensive to me. As the war progressed, I felt that we were being lied to. And while I agreed with the premise and the spirit of those who were opposed to the war, I was appalled and offended at the attitude that some people in the country had toward those people conducting the war or fighting in the war. The leadership should have been the ones who bore the brunt of their disdain and their rebuke. Certainly not the young men.
There's a blizzard coming on. How I'm wishing I was home. For my pony's lame.
There's a student of mine who's basically lost, he and his brothers. I taught another, two of his brothers. They basically lost. Their mother committed suicide. Their father, who spent two tours in Vietnam, and I'm not sure what kind of shock he experienced, but he's back. He's been in Vietnam now. He went back to Vietnam. He's never returned. His sons have not seen him in several years. And I think there's a war that was precipitated on a hoax. My feeling is, and I think about Eisenhower, a great president, I think, in many ways. Prophetic in one sense when he said we have to be concerned about the growth of the military-industrial complex. And today, our nation is pretty much founded, from my perspective and from what I know, which may be very little, but from what I know, we would fall apart economically if it wasn't for that military-industrial complex. So, you know, and from that perspective, Eisenhower was a prophet. On the other hand, he was one of the foremost advocates of the domino theory, which we now know was like the Soviet Union. That was as factual as the strength of the Soviet Union. They imploded. And I think Alan and one of you guys talked about the leadership. And we'd like to think that the leadership in our country was brilliant and looked at everything objectively, understood who they were putting in harm's way and why.
These five brothers, Republicans, a carpenter, a congressman, a mailman who's a minister in New Jersey state prisons, a sporting goods owner, and a retired high school teacher who's a county commissioner, are steeped in conservative values. Search for an America that does not walk in lockstep, but one that is whole and honest. Welcome back to Shared Weight, the story of the Gilchrist brothers, of Republican Congressman Wayne Gilchrist, his brothers Jeffrey and Alan, who served with him in Vietnam, brother Richard, who served in the Navy, and Clifford, who remained home to teach. We rejoin the brothers as they reflect on how their views of the world have grown since that war and been affected by that war.
When the three of you came back from Vietnam, it feels like you were all affected by this very differently.
You didn't mention it. You were afraid to say you were in Vietnam.
No, you didn't even say you were a vet.
You didn't say you were in Vietnam. No.
I was sitting in a coffee shop downtown. I was renting a small house in Rahway, New Jersey at the time. And I was having my breakfast by myself. I got off the bus the day before, finally got home from Vietnam. Nobody met me. I'm having breakfast and two men are laughing and looking at the newspaper calling us baby killers and women killers. I finished my breakfast and left. Never said a word or said anything.
No, you didn't.
It didn't become publicly known. And that's how I've been ever since, basically. But once in a while, I do get a little annoyed at some fellas. But it doesn't do any good, because basically they've already made up their mind because of the confusion that Wayne was talking about. Well, you have to keep it inside. You know, that's the difference between the reason we don't talk about it. There's a lot of things that have never come out since this particular day, right now. Mm-hmm. And even though they may be small, there's certain things that still stick with me. The odor of Vietnam, the smell.
Yeah, we got it.
Yeah. You know what Jeffrey's saying? We have never sat down and talked about this.
Mm-hmm. Never talked about Vietnam.
We have never.
My children had any family gathering.
We've always avoided politics and war.
That's right.
Always.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because that highway is too vast. I think
it's easier now than when we were 20.
Yeah, well, only because maybe there'll be an influence on somebody who's wondering what about it.
Well, I talked to an individual on that.
Because if you are an anti-something, don't just be an anti-something with a crowd. Try to do something about the problem.
In some ways, emotionally, Vietnam hits you pretty deep.
The results?
Well, I think most of them, when they came back, that was, you know, there was no welcome. Because you just think of the other, what would you come home a conquering hero? Well, we came back and hid. My children were 13 and 14 years old before they knew I was in Vietnam. And the only reason I spoke was they were being taught wrong in school. On the history of it, I took the history book is wrong. And then it hit me there, but we didn't know you were there, Dad. I never mentioned, my wife never mentioned that I was in Vietnam. I just put it away.
In a way, we were a little embarrassed. We didn't feel like heroes. But at the same time, I would not put someone down for what's happening right now. Never, because those men are trying their darndest to do what they are told and what they can do as Americans. And we started out in chaos. How many hundreds of years ago? We started out with chaos, and it's been that way ever since.
When you think about what's happening today, and as you reflect on what really happened in Vietnam, the fact that when Jeffrey came home from that war, it had to feel that kind of rejection because of people like Johnson and McNamara and what's his name, Alan?
Westmoreland.
And individuals who knew all along that they were lying, and that there were countless numbers of young men being murdered and maimed, and countless numbers of innocent Vietnamese people losing their lives, losing their environment, and knowing what the napalm was probably going to do. The number of people who, what's his name, Rickover? Was it Admiral Rickover? I mean, the number of people who, in this country, who suffered as a result of that. And then knowing what the leadership of this government is doing in this country and not doing, the things that they are more than likely knowingly concealing from the American people.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
I asked them how they look to the world now, 35 years after the end of the war they fought in.
Vision softly creeping, left its seeds while I was sleeping.
I think it's a sad time right now in American history that we're redoing the same mistakes we made in the 50s and the 60s, not being sophisticated enough to distinguish between Stalinism, Maoism, and colonies that wanted to be independent.
Hitlerism.
Yeah, we're
bringing that up all
and,
the time.
And to associate the Islamic world with World War II or the Nazis is really, really bad. And to make a comment about Islamic fascists, when there is no such thing as an Islamic fascist. If you're a Muslim, you are from an Abrahamic tradition, a Christian tradition, where you believe in one God, and to please that God, you treat your neighbor as yourself, and you do justice to all humanity. We are not sophisticated enough to know the difference between a murderer, a terrorist, an insurgent, and a Muslim. And we're not sophisticated enough to know the difference between how Islam is practiced in Iran, how it's practiced in Syria, how it's practiced in Lebanon, or Pakistan, or any other of those countries. It's their religion and their culture. And there are no evil empires. Now, if we learn anything about Vietnam, the average Vietnamese person that we came in contact with, whether it was Saigon,
Mr. Phu, or some mountainous village.
Mama son and baby son washed my clothes, cleaned my shoes, made my bed.
I went to baptisms.
They were human beings.
They were human beings that wanted to live their life, that wanted to have weddings for their children, that wanted to be good teachers, good scientists, good carpenters, good people that raised rice. Now, in the Middle East, the average Iranian, the average Syrian, the average anybody, whether they're a scientist or a carpenter, a teacher or a plumber or a truck driver or whatever they are, those are the ones who directly hold the fibers of the society together. So they're not a part of an evil empire. And the key thing now, as we didn't have back then, is dialogue. We should begin talking to these countries. It's better to talk first and hold the shooting till much later.
I don't know why we're afraid to do that. You can get a lot done, whether you agree or disagree.
Well, I think from now on, it's just a mention of not the biggest excuse now is 9/11. So the fear factor is just being used at such a high level, and since that day, all bets are off. There is no it's all right because of 9/11. Everything goes back to 9/11, and now that's the reason for everything going on in the world today, or what our policy is. It's just 9/11. And so they get everybody thinking back to that day and bring you back into the fold of that terrible, terrible day, tragic day. And that, and they haven't let that. That's the whole of the whole situation now, as far as mentioned, you know, axes of evil and this country and that country.
This government tries to put itself up. The Puritan who claimed, you know, that we're going to build a city on a hill. It's going to be a light unto the world, and it just, I get so angry when I think about. Wayne talked about the different Muslim cultures in the different countries, and how for the most part Islam is a religion of peace. And what Osama bin Laden has done, what kind of evangelical has Osama bin Laden been to Islam? And how he has distorted, because of his hatred, how he has distorted that belief around the world. What has our nation, our president done to the Christian faith? I thought about the other day, if you had a person in a third world country, parts of Ethiopia where our son is, where there's no communication, if you had that person who is looking for guidance, for direction, And he was trying to find a faith that he or she could hang on to. And you took bin Laden as a disciple of Islam, and you took George Bush as a disciple of Christianity. And you look at what they talk about, and if you took quotes, you could cherry pick those quotes. But what have their lives, what have their decisions that they have made? What is our government's decision about torture? Even though it's now they're kind of reversing course. But what does that say about Christianity? And Jeffrey talked about talking. What's wrong with talking with one another? Didn't Christ, if Christ is the paragon of Christianity, didn't Christ talk to everybody? Didn't he go into the homes of those people who were either considered sacred, or the Jews? You know, he talked to the Gentiles and everybody. And our government, current government, is unwilling to talk to those infidels. And I guess as a result, what bothers me most is that the number of people here and there and everywhere around the world whose lives are being either thrown into turmoil, who, as Alan said, won't see their daughters or sons get married, won't see their grandchildren. And isn't that life of that child in Lebanon or Israel or Iraq or Iran or Darfur or any number of a million other places? Oklahoma. Isn't that life of that little child? Yeah, Oklahoma. The kids in Oklahoma.
This is why Clifford was spared not going to Vietnam, because his emotions and his way of expressing things, it's so intense that it's, I'm not saying, not to say that it isn't healthy, it's just that people with such insight are more affected even by not even being in a situation that is horrible.
My brother-in-law, who's never been to church or whatever, he brought it up. He lives in Pennsylvania, and you know, never was in the service. But he says, I don't want to, and he knows where I'm coming from, all right? I serve Jesus Christ. And
your brother-in-law now?
This is my brother-in-law. He knows I'm in, this is why we're here. The only purpose here is we are made for his purpose. He said, I don't want to say anything, Al, but the president uses the faith card too much. And he said, whoops, you're not hurting my feelings in any way, shape, or form. He says, I don't go to church, and I don't, never been to church, but I know one thing, that he uses that faith card too much. Now, that is simplifying, but I'll tell you, that's basically what Cliff is saying, because we had a beautiful opportunity. The Lord just put on my spirit that we had at that time, rather than up, our enemy was elected. That election doesn't count. We had an opportunity to go in and say, okay, let's work together. That doesn't mean they're going to accept it, but this is what the Christian would do in the faith. They would follow the teachings that you confound your enemy. Mm-hmm. We had an opportunity to go in there and build that up. To build Gaza up, that not stop their produce from crossing into, everything was cut off. European Union, no more aid. Not thinking about those people, the same middle class people as it is here today. They were unable to sell their goods. Food rotting in the gardens, on the farms. We had a beautiful opportunity, men of faith. That would have, I feel in my spirit, and from that very day, that would have turned that Gaza around, just to give that hand. That's what it's all about. Not like today, they're stopping the medication coming across the border from Canada. They said Bush finally found a free trade he didn't like. And it's true. You see what I'm saying?
In all the questioning of the intentions of our leaders that came to them after the war, they're clear about what kind of America they want.
The paradox of our country is that our strength arrives from our differences, from our disagreements, from our arguments. That's where the fiber of this society gets its strength, in its ability to express strong differences of opinions. And in a general sense, there is tolerance for that mix. That's our strength.
While the dew is still on the road.
5 young men supported the war in Vietnam. 3 served there. They all began to question authority after the war, but maintained their rock-bed conservative hopes for our country. But none of them will ever again be blinded by anyone's ideology, nor will they take political leaders' utterances as gospel. Thank you for listening to Shared Weight and the story of the Gilchrist brothers. To hear the rest of the story, go to www.centerforemergingmedia.com. And thanks for listening. This has been a production from the Center for Emerging Media. Major funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Osprey Foundation. Executive producer, Mark Steiner. Producers, Steve Elliott and Mark Steiner. Editor and engineer, Andrew Epic. Studio recording and mixing facilities provided by Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design. For a complete listing of funders and participants in this program, go to www.centerforemergingmedia.com.